self-esteem, I think, won the battle for the popular mind. And so you got this huge self-esteem movement that was focused because they thought incorrectly that just by praising children and lowering standards, people would feel better about themselves and all these good events, all these good things would follow.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimalwork.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass, which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimalwork.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, glad to have you back on the show.
Hey, Sharif, thanks for having me back. It's really great.
Yeah, anytime. Well, Kevin, I thought, you know, I'm always proposing the topic here and coming up with things, but I thought maybe we could switch things up and give you a chance to talk about something that you're interested in and, you know, something that you've been thinking about. So I don't know if you have any suggested topics for us today.
I do, yeah. I have been getting more into the work of Albert Bandura and was very happy to discover he and I have followed a similar path in a lot of ways. That he, back in the 1960s, so he was a psychologist, he was at Stanford, was an expert on helping people overcome their fear of snakes. And that would be one of my favorite jobs. If there was a living to be made in helping people overcome fear of snakes, I have actually looked into getting a python for my office just in case I would have a patient who was afraid of snakes. Unfortunately, in all my years, and it's been like, you know, almost 20 years now, and I've never once had a person come to me with a fear of snakes. But somehow, Bandura had all these people with the fear of snakes, and he was able to test different ways of treating them. And what he discovered was that, well, one, if you model for people handling a snake and then let them gently get more and more involved in handling the snake, that's the most effective way. So there's this idea that they can gain mastery, you know, of the snake gradually, and you keep modeling for them how to do it. Okay, that makes perfect sense. He discovered, though, that once the people in the studies got over their fear of snakes, for many, it was a life-changing experience. All these things that they had been avoiding, they started being more daring and going into. So he got fascinated by the sense of freedom that they had, that they got unstuck in different areas of life. And that's what led him to develop then his big theory of self-efficacy. That he thought these people got a boost, that they can do things that they had previously thought were off limits. And that boost is what then now they transferred to other things. And they learned to gain mastery in one specific area, snakes. And then now they can do it in other areas like driving or getting that promotion or dating the person or things that they had been avoiding. And in the end, self-efficacy got applied then in a very deep way to helping people to work better, and particularly in academic work. So he made this interesting transition from anxiety to work, and saw self-efficacy as the bridge. So I thought that's just fascinating, that it's so similar to the kind of the career transition that I've had.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the first thing about snakes is interesting because, Kevin, we've known each other for a while, and you know that I have a crippling fear of snakes, and you still haven't helped me with it. But
just have to get that python.
I haven't let you help me with it because forget it. So I guess one of the things that strikes me is the relationship between mastery and confidence. And I think sometimes when people are trying to help others, and this is maybe why like the whole positive self-talk or just kind of giving encouragement, it really has to hinge on also in helping the person become capable of engaging the challenge. And I think it's one good example might be public speaking, where it's not really that helpful to say like, oh yeah, you can do it. Like they're going to love you. but it's really much more helpful to give people the skills of public speaking and the steps. Like, okay, you want to grab their attention with a story, you want to lay out clearly, you know, the points you want to make, and then give people tips on intonation in their voice and engaging with humor. So it's really giving people the skills of mastery that then helps them develop confidence. And is that one of the key points here?
Yeah, when you look into it, being able to take a task and break it down into steps is the number one thing you can do to improve self-efficacy. But in the research, they never actually give that a name. So they'll talk about it later as one of the aspects of self-regulation. And then you have this mouthful that they develop, self-efficacy for self-regulation, which is your ability to change yourself, which is kind of getting at this more general idea of self-efficacy. It's not just about being able to dive off the 5 meter or to dive off the 3 meter diving board. But it's also about your ability to acquire new skills and applying it to that. So what I like about self-efficacy is it does kind of scale up to more general areas. Maybe it gets a little bit unclear what they're talking about when it gets to very general, because originally self-efficacy was just the prediction that you have of being able to attain a desired outcome, you know, by applying your given level of mastery. So do I have enough mastery to attain the outcome that I want? So that's essentially how it was originally seen. So it was always originally seen in the literature, it was described as being very context specific. So you might be high on self-efficacy in math, but not in Spanish. And you can, you know, your self-efficacy for handling mice is very high, but snakes is very low.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Yeah, so, okay, quick question about that. Is it about your rating of your own of your current level of mastery, or is it about your confidence in your ability to develop greater mastery? Like, so
yes,
it's kind of like a growth
mindset.
Interestingly,
it's not about whether or not you have a skill. Is it whether you can deploy the skill effectively in a given situation? So, for instance, I can have total confidence that I can play, let's say, Clair de Lune, although there are parts that I habitually skip. But for the most part, I can play Clair de Lune. But if I were to be playing in front of a large audience, I actually am not sure I could do it. So, because I always, you know, I just don't have that many opportunities to practice being in front of audiences playing the piano. If I was serious about growing in that way and it somehow is important, well, then I would work towards it. And I'd like find smaller ways. I would take it, play, you know, more simple things in front of audiences, and then work up the complexity of the things I play in front of audiences. But that's the kind of sense that can you take whatever desired outcome? It could be playing Clair de Lune in front of 200 people in a recital in the Sanders Theater at Harvard. Okay, girl, that would be, that would be kind of daunting. But then you can break it down into steps. So whenever you can take something and start to break it into smaller things and then break those into actual steps that you're going to do, the act of breaking something into steps is a cognitive strategy that allows you to develop the sense of self-efficacy. Because each step you can be pretty sure you can do. And then it's like learning how to dive, okay, that you have to bend the legs, you have to lean forward, and you have to make the jump. So you kind of learn, okay, here's the normal thing I do, these three things. And then I know if I just do them in that order, it's going to, the form will follow. And for whatever else. I'm thinking of the, in What About Bob, when Dr. Leo Marvin is trying to teach his son how to dive. And he's actually a very bad teacher. but at least he was trying to break it down into steps. So that's one thing.
So, okay. When you talk about the tie-in with work, and so I can see that maybe playing devil's advocate a little bit, because generally I'm on board with the idea that growth and work transfers to other areas. But let me just see how you would respond to this. You mentioned that in work, you're learning how to break things down into steps, and then that is key to self-efficacy. So then you grow in kind of this general ability. So you can kind of work your growth. But it seems like in these other areas, there's a huge emotional component, you know, in fear of snakes, for instance. Mm-hmm. But with work, you know, maybe working on a report or, you know, a presentation or, you know, programming something, it seems like that wouldn't necessarily give you that confidence that you can engage a more emotional type or like anxiety or fear sort of challenge. So how do you bridge that gap for people? I mean, I'm confident that if I, you know, encounter some difficult programming task, I can think through the steps and accomplish that. But how do I get that to transfer then to a high stakes, anxiety inducing challenge?
So that's a key aspect of self-efficacy. It's the ability to handle your own physiology. So, and that plays a large role in determining, you know, are you able to effectively do this task in this particular context? So there are four main sources of self-efficacy that Bandura mentions. The first is mastery, and that's your past experiences with mastering this kind of activity. The second is modeling. Have you seen others do this successfully? The more you've seen others, the more confident you can be that you could do it too. The third is persuasion, which is others can tell you, hey, we know you can do this. So we've seen you dive off things before. You can dive off this one. You'll be great. And then the fourth is physiology. And that's very important. It's your ability to manage your own emotions and feeling states. I think one of the things that undermines self-efficacy for many of us is the uncertainty about, can we handle anxiety in a given situation? The more completely assured you are that no matter what is going on with your adrenaline, you can always take it and flip it to help you go into flow, well, that is, I think, one of the greatest boosters of general self-efficacy. Because really, one of the things I think that is most general about all the challenges that you can be efficacious in meeting, what's most general is the sense of the alarm that you have within you. So the adrenaline system and your ability to flip it from being in fight or flight to now being into this flow boosting focus, that ability, that confidence, I think makes up for a huge amount of self-efficacy, thinking of it more generally, because it is then a more general system.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe that's a good place to dive into this distinction between self-efficacy in certain situations versus a general kind of skill of self-efficacy. And I guess Bandura says he's focusing on self-efficacy in a certain specific situation, right? But I mean, it seems like
there's this little bit of tension. Yeah, because the way he described it initially was general, that he helped people overcome their phobia of snakes. And then he noticed all of these changes. But what's interesting is when he got down to really doing the research and writing about it, it seems like it got very constricted on the ability to attain a particular what, you know, by applying a particular skill at a particular moment. So you have these three elements. You have the what you're trying to attain, the how you're trying to do it, the skill that you're trying to apply, and then the particular when you're doing it. So it got very defined when it came down, very context specific. People then later tried to come up with going back to a more generalized scale. But when you look and see at what that generalized scale measures, it's kind of fuzzy. And a lot of it has to do with the ability to just form strategies when you're facing a challenge. So if you could just come up with this belief that I know that when I face challenges, that I am able to strategize. I can strategize when I face any challenge. In my mind, that's like 80% then of what they call general self-efficacy. Well, that's important. I think it's really important that people, when they get challenges, they don't just try to push through them, that they pause to really reflect on what is the best way of doing this. Can they come up with different strategies? That's also an important part of general self-efficacy. You can come up with more than one strategy. Another important part is you can manage the physiology, that somehow this stuff all predates the real, like what I consider the gold approach of flipping the fear into focus. But they have this idea that somehow it's not an obstacle. You can manage your anxiety whenever it comes. Right. So there are these senses where you have this ability to deploy strategies while managing the activation that you get. Okay, that's probably very close to being the sum of general self-efficacy.
Yeah. Now it seems like that is missing the reframing part where we talk about, okay, seeing the challenge is a good thing, learning to flip it from viewing it as a threat to viewing it as an opportunity. And yeah, I guess sometimes when I'm explaining, you know, optimal work and reframing to people, I say that, okay, you need to see the challenge as good, and you also need to see that good as like possible. So it's good and it's possible to obtain that. And so what he's talking about here is the possibility of performing well, which by strategies and so forth. But it doesn't have the sense yet of reframing and learning to see the challenge as a good thing. Is that right?
Well, I think that did develop within the self-efficacy kind of movement where, so I sent you actually once this quote from, I don't actually know how to say his name, Pajares, so is the best I can do. And he said that people with a strong sense of self-efficacy approach difficult tasks as challenges to be mastered rather than as threats to be avoided. Now, that's a really nice statement, isn't it? That's extremely close to what we talk about in optimal work. And it's the closest I've ever seen in the psychology literature. So it's fascinating that some people in the self-efficacy movement understand this, that he's talking here about a strong sense of self-efficacy. I think he's talking about general self-efficacy. And so he's talking about this ability to then see challenges as something to be mastered. So you can develop mastery. That's the reframe. So self-efficacy thinks of reframing as the kind of mastery you want to be developing in a given challenge. So another way of looking at it is that self-efficacy is always a kind of prediction that you will be able to attain an outcome by applying a skill. Well, that prediction, how do we shape predictions? Again, there are two ways we shape our brain's ability to predict what's coming next. One of those is by breaking it down into steps that we will follow when doing it. Another way is by reframing the entire challenge as an opportunity for some kind of learning, growth, and practice. So I think that the self-efficacy literature doesn't get totally to where we talk about growth, and because it's really focused on outcomes. So, and so it's talking about your ability to attain certain outcomes by applying skills. It's thinking about, okay, is there a way of improving those skills? But I'm not sure it just dives deep into that. See, I think what we talk about as reframing is, how do you take this given what, and then think about how you're going to do it and why you're going to do it? So we think of the reframe as being, what is the exact pattern of the skill or ideal or bond that you are going to be, you know, you're going to be seeking to bring into this action? So for us, reframing always has this kind of, it's like that the task is just the matter, but the reframe is the form. So, and you're trying to shape the matter of the task with this form, which is, what is the kind of skill quality bond that I want to be deepening when I do this? And that has to be for some ultimate end, which goes beyond the task. There has to be a why. Otherwise, you could be really efficacious at getting to particular outcomes, but you'd get them and you'd be like, okay, well, why did I do that? So self-efficacy on its own is actually rudderless. It doesn't tell us anything about what's meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I'm interested to understand how self-efficacy fits into the larger picture of the landscape of kind of research and academic psychology or clinical therapy even. So what are the alternate approaches that people tend to take for someone who says, yeah, I'm not mm-hmm. really big into the whole self-efficacy thing? What mm-hmm. what would they be doing here?
Most people who know about self-efficacy like it. So there are good instruments that can measure it, particularly for specific things like academic performance. So self-efficacy has been really well studied. We even know that you can measure the self-efficacy of teachers regarding their ability to teach, and that, in fact, can be improved by teaching them reframing and strategies. So you can help them attain like more mastery. If you improve the self-efficacy of a teacher, you actually improve the grades, the objective grades of the class. So there's a sense that teaching has been a wonderful arena for studying self-efficacy on the part of students and on the part of teachers. Self-efficacy, in fact, is malleable. So by working with people and helping them to strategize, which I think is just taking a goal and dividing it into steps, the goal is given by what is the kind of, not just the outcome, not just the what, but really the how and the why shaping. I think that's the most meaningful way to do it. But I'm adding, we add the why. That's not part of the research. Okay, so broadly speaking, I think self-efficacy has its opposite concept in self-esteem. Self-esteem is more a judgment that people make about themselves. It tends to be global. It tends to be this assessment of worth. So, and trying to make the judgment that one is worthy. So, in a way, they arose at similar times in different environments. And self-esteem, I think, won the battle for the popular mind. And so you got this huge self-esteem movement that was focused because they thought incorrectly that just by praising children and lowering standards, people would feel better about themselves and all these good events, all these good things would follow. So self-esteem, I think, lost the research battle. Because it was eventually shown that improving self-esteem didn't really, to the extent you could do it, it's not that malleable. It doesn't really correlate with real-world benefits. And you can look and see, if you do one intervention to improve self-efficacy and another to improve self-esteem, how do they do? And self-efficacy wins. So self-efficacy is very anchored, not in judgments about oneself, which are kind of imaginary, but in the real application of skills to concrete tasks. And because it's kind of connected to work, it's connected to the applying skills to tasks, it ends up producing then the best outcomes. Because I think that work is how you produce the best outcomes. But work isn't just about the task, it's also about the application of skills and ideals to the task.
Okay, Kevin, the last idea I want to tie in here, because it is the idea of Carol Dweck's idea of growth mindset, which seems like it fits in very well with self-efficacy. So self-efficacy seems to be about a specific situation that I can do well in this situation, whereas growth mindset is a little bit more about your, even if I don't do well, at least I learned something and I can grow and I can do better the next time. So I'm interested to see how you think those two fit together. And then it seems they fit together nicely, whereas with self-esteem, it doesn't exactly fit. So I'm kind of interested to see how you think about those two.
I think with self-efficacy, you can see how people can grow in it bit by bit. Every single time you take a challenge and break it down into steps and think about what's the highest goal I can set in this challenge, your confidence in engaging these kinds of challenges will increase. So very strong self-efficacy, I think, is basically the same idea as self-confidence. So because you are confident that you can apply a skill in a given context. So growth mindset is more about how you get there. And it's implied when we say you can, whenever you face a challenge, you can break it down into steps and that will increase your sense of efficacy. Well, that idea that you can increase your self-efficacy by doing these things already implicitly contains the idea of a growth mindset. Because if mastery was just a given given fixed thing, then you would never be able to do anything to improve it. So you couldn't ever increase self-efficacy. Another way of thinking of it is that because self-efficacy is so tied to your ability to work challenges, you know, this idea that I can, when a challenge comes, I can work it. It is free from fixed mindset by its very nature. Because working challenges is the same as growing. Work, your ability to work a challenge, is your ability to grow in that challenge. The reframe gives you the pattern of how you want to grow, and then you break it down into steps. So you're always thinking strategically about the challenges that you face. And we do this all the time. All day long, we're facing little challenges and we have little strategies for how we manage them.
Wonderful. Okay, Kevin. Well, I think that's basically it for today. I think we're out of time here.
All right, Sharif. Well, great. Until next time.
Okay. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com. Our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.